Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Thanks for calling in. I ran across a story a couple weeks ago, and we talked about it on the show, and I asked for Shelley to kind of research it. Shelley, if you all don't know this, I think most of you do, is writing a book. Shelley is a major, major animal lover. When I first met Shelley, she had she was running a ferret rescue. And I know there's probably a lot of people who have gotten close and personal with a ferret, but there's probably a lot more that have not. In my family, we've had ferrets. They are very social, very loving, and can be one of the sweetest pets you'll ever have in your life. Well, the first time I went to Shelley's house, she had it all set up so that it was definitely a ferret rescue. And sadly, some of them came to her very ill. Ferrets have issues with their adrenals. But most of them, when you walked by, they would reach for you. Actually reach their little hand out of their cage and try to get your attention to have an interaction with you. It was really kind of surreal the first time I went in. Then I got accustomed to it. And, of course, she's always had dogs, cats, all of the above. Many years ago, Jeffrey and I at the Institute, we have lots of stories about animals at the Institute, and one morning we found two pups that were starving to death. They looked to be black labs, and they were just skin and bones. So we gathered them up, brought them to my office, and I said to Jeff, I said, there's only one person that I think could deal with these two pups. And he said, who, Shelley? And I said, exactly. So they were so hungry that I was afraid they would get sick. So I kept them in my office until Shelley got there and just hand-fed them bits and pieces of dog food. Because puppies are like little kids, you know, they'll eat until they throw up. So I have a visual in my mind, the two of them sitting down on my feet, and just laying into my legs because they were so glad that they had been rescued. Shelley still has these two dogs, and there's been heartache involved because they were not as healthy as they needed to be because somebody abandoned them. But she has also written lots of paper on the treatment of animals, and I read some of it. I'm going to be honest. It's hard for me to read. It's not something that I can sink my teeth into because I don't like to think that we can be that way. I know we are. We're like that with human beings. So it doesn't surprise me that we're like that with animals. But Shelley has really sunk her teeth into this, and she's made this a part of her life. So when this story came up, at first I was like, can this be true, Shel? And she said, yeah, it is true. She says, I've read about this before, that the pacing of a tiger or another kind of a wild cat or the rocking, the swaying of elephants. I thought they were doing that because they were like, you know, relaxing themselves. Well, indeed they are because they're stressed. And one of the videos showed a bear just walking in a circle, in a circle, in a circle. So when I asked Shel if she thought that this was really an issue, and she said yes, I asked her to do a little bit of research. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I invite anybody who has any input on that to call in at 347-989-0352 and give us your input. I would hate to see the big top and our local zoos taken away, but I certainly would be an advocate of treating our wildlife with respect. So let me bring Shel in. Good morning, honey.
Well, good morning, Rainey. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing real good. Now, one of the things I wanted to say real quick when you were talking about the ferret rescue, the only ferrets that were in cages were the ferrets that were being quarantined. 90% of the ferrets were in free-roaming areas. I had a free-roaming environment so that they weren't caged all day long. They had these large free-run areas with open cages that were multiple tiers, and they could kind of run up and down them as like a jungle gym, but then they could exit the cages into an open floor area that had toys and other ferrets. So they were very socialized. Generally, in each free-roaming area, there was about anywhere from 20 to 25 ferrets, because I had over 100, and I had four free-roaming areas, and then the cage room was strictly for sick ferrets or quarantine ferrets that I just got in, because sometimes they carried illnesses and I didn't want it going through, you know, if I got a sick ferret in, I wouldn't be able to know for a day or two. So when I would first take in a rescue, I would put it in the quarantine room to make sure it wasn't sick, and then I would socialize it with an appropriate group.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that that's the way it worked. When I mentioned the fact that they would reach out of the cages, of course, those were the quarantine ones, and they were still very social. But kind of a memory that I will never, probably ever forget. I had on, as usual, a long skirt, and I went into the arena where they all ran free, and several of them climbed right up my skirts to get to me. Just, you know, dug right in and climbed right up my skirts to get to me. I thought it was hysterical. And and if they would hear Shell's voice, you would see the recognition on their adorable little faces. So I guess the point I'm trying to make, first of all, is that Shelley was very good at that and continues to be a real advocate for our wildlife in every way, shape, and form. But I also want to bring into this that those are the kind of people that should work in zoos and circuses.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't have to worry so much if that's the only people that worked at zoos and circuses.
Right.
There are
right.
people out there who are it's just like the adoption agency. It's just like
mm-hmm.
everything. You
right.
know, you also get some pediatric nurses that don't like kids. For God's sakes, what are they doing there?
Exactly.
Right?
Why would they even a profession? How many times you go into like animal care and control, and there's people there that hate animals. It's like, well, what'd you get that job for? It's the same thing. It's like, I don't understand why people take jobs where they have to deal with the public, you know, a customer service position, but they hate people, and they can't they can't stand hearing people complain. Well, what'd you take a customer service job for then? Because that's all you're going to be dealing with all day long, you know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, and when you have to control anything. Anything, whether it's an animal, a person, a situation, if you don't have the caring for it, the love for it, the empathy for it, you'll be mean. You'll
mm-hmm.
be mean.
Exactly.
And you know, maybe it's not even your fault. I'm not trying to point my finger at anybody. Just don't get involved in it. So, like, I mean, we've all seen stories of good and bad stories of racehorses that were so loved, I mean, so loved, that, you know, they ran their life, literally, in races and were big winners and everything and were truly loved by their owners. Then we've seen stories where amazing horses that were racehorses were abused and didn't see it through, you know, their career wasn't seen through because the people that owned them didn't love them, didn't care for them. So it all boils down, I mean, imagine, Shell, I'm 66 years old. I've been to the circus probably 30 times in my life. I love the circus.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the animals. I have total respect. I remember as a little girl, I stuck my hand in to a small cage where there was a baby fox because it looked like a Pomeranian to me. I just thought it was absolutely adorable, just waiting for me to scoop it up. I was maybe 3 or 4 years old. And my grandfather very gently took my hand and said, he doesn't know you, Mickey. He
yep.
always called me Mickey. He doesn't know you, Mickey, so he might not like you putting your hand in there. He didn't tell me the fox is going to bite you,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was good because then I didn't have a fear of them. But, you know, he taught me to be respectful. So the only thing I have fear of is we all know it should, I should have a big T-shirt that says it is snakes. I'm afraid of snakes. And I've had many people try to talk me through it. And I just have a fear of them.
Yep.
So what do you think about this thing? This was very upsetting for me. Every time I close my eyes, I can see the bear walking in the circle. I can see the animals, the elephants with, you mentioned it to me, with their one leg always tied to a stake. And before
right.
you
well,
said that to me, I knew that, but it wasn't registering with me. You know what
right.
I mean?
Well, one of the things you have to understand, all right, and it's I'm going to get into some of the specifics of what happens at zoos and at circuses. It's really important to understand that so much of what we do in society is cultural, is upbringing, is familiarity. I grew up going to the circuses, and I have good memories of it. I've gone to aquariums, and I've gone to animal shows. I've gone to many, many zoos. When we took our New York City trip, what was that, over a decade ago, we went to the, I think it was the Brooklyn Zoo or something, and it was wonderful seeing animals. But now that I recognize some of the things I'm seeing, I don't get the same enjoyment. And we have an attitude which is almost bred into most humans that exploiting animals for us is okay, that there's nothing wrong with that, okay? But when you go deeper and you start thinking about exploiting animals, it becomes a bigger issue. So I want to cover one thing quickly, and then I'm going to get into the specifics of circus acts and of the of zoos. But there's something, a book I had read, PETA talks about this all the time, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, that's PETA. ARF has also ran a lot of articles about this. Now, ARF is the Animal Rights Foundation of Florida. They are also the founders of the Sublime Restaurant in Fort Lauderdale. All right, it's the same group, ARF. And they put out weekly flyers. Now, I have their flyer dating all the way back to 2005, and they were heavily, heavily campaigning to get rid of some of the zoos in South Florida that were major, major offenders of just common sense sensitivity. So I'm going to read part of that article in a minute. But one of the things I got from Vegan Outreach, which is another organization that tries to inspire people to choose to become vegetarian and vegan. Vegan Outreach is a wonderful organization. They have all kinds of publications where you can get vegan starter kits explaining, you know, some of the myths about not getting protein if you become vegan and all that. And they did I have one of their magazines here where they had done an excerpt on a section from Peter Singer's book. Peter Singer wrote a book called Animal Liberation. It was one of the first books I read back in 1997 when everything got turned upside down for me. I had been a meat eater my entire life. I was, I think I was 39 years old at the time. I had very poorly feeling health. I'd been sick for 30 years, and the doctors weren't giving me any answers. And so I started reading, and every book I read started talking about changing diet. So I found this book called Animal Liberation, and it was a very disturbing book to me because he talked about animal experiments. He talked about factory farms and how the animals were treated. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because that same mindset that we're brought up with leads into circus acts, leads into zoos, leads into rodeos, where we look at using animals in an exploitive way for our pleasure, whether it be for our meal, whether it be for entertainment, to the detriment of the animals. And most people don't recognize that the animals are being harmed, or they recognize it and they accept it because they've been conditioned to do that. So one of the things that he brought out, and it's remarkable. I mean, he did this as a study because he studied religions and he studied our attitudes. He was a meat eater when he started his research, and while he wrote this book, he became a vegetarian. So he talks about his own personal journey in the beginning of the book and how what he researched just impacted him so greatly that he couldn't remain a meat eater the more and more he learned about this. And then he started combating things that were done to animals in other arenas like circuses and things like that. So what he coined a phrase called speciesism. Now, like racism, but this is speciesism, okay? So it's the same beginning. And speciesism is the act of treating an individual not according to its characteristics, such as the ability to suffer, but according to the species to which that individual belongs. Basic rights on species is arbitrary. It is no more rational than basing rights on the pigmentation of a skin or on gender or on which religion somebody aligns themselves with. As a society, we recognize basic rights of humans in their lives and bodies. We consider these rights inalienable, meaning that no one can take them away. Humans are granted rights to their lives because most have strong desire to avoid death and suffer fear when their lives are threatened. Humans are granted control over their own bodies because they suffer pain when their bodies are mutilated, boredom and frustration when caged for long periods of time. Since we are a society, we understand how horrible these sorts of sufferings are. We try to protect humans from those who might kill, mutilate, or cage them, regardless of the benefits to the others that suffering might bring about. Think about the laws that were changed with prisoners of war. All right, so here you have a prisoner of war, all right, and obviously torturing that prisoner would benefit the other side. We even have international laws against torturing prisoners of war, all right? So going back to the article, based on common physiology and behavior, it is safe to say that all vertebrate animals suffer fear when their lives are threatened, pain when their bodies are mutilated, and boredom and frustration when caged for long periods of time. In speaking about whether or not animals should be granted rights, Jeremy Bentham, an Oxford University professor of jurisprudence, said that the question is not can they reason, nor can they talk, but rather can they suffer. And this is something people don't think about when they're talking about utilizing animals. They look at animal as a product. They don't look at it as a sentient being. For those who can suffer, the degree of suffering, not the species of the sufferer, is what should count. Similarly, if an individual desires to live, then its life should be respected. Animals show they value their lives and freedom by their struggles against being caged and killed. The act of depriving them of life or freedom harms them in many of the same ways a human is harmed when deprived of life or freedom. Since animals can feel pain and desire to live, should they be granted basic rights to their lives and bodies? As individuals capable of acting morally, how can we justify their continued exploitation and slaughter? And then there's an excerpt here from Peter Singer. He says, all arguments to prove human superiority cannot shatter this one hard fact. In suffering, the animals are our equals. So these are some of the things I read back in 1997, which really turned a lot of my attitude towards animals, towards things like the circus and the zoos and things like that, really on their sides, because it put everything in a new perspective for me. It's a wonderful book, very well written. Like I said, it's called Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. There's been a lot of other books since this have come out because he was the first one who came up with that whole idea of speciesism, and a lot of other animal activists have now ran with that. There's all the other people that have written books and other articles now, but he was the one who started that, and through his research, he started recognizing that the way we treat animals is the way we've also treated people. When you look at the Nazis who took people and put them in concentration camps, they looked at the Jews and other like Polish people and things like that as lesser than the Nazis were, as being less entitled to normal compassion and treatment, and they had no concern for their suffering. So it's that pervasive human attitude that allows things like this to go unchecked for so long, because we're almost conditioned not to see the suffering of the animals. One other word, and then I'll actually get into some of the details. There's a word called anthropomorphism, big word. it's been used by the scientific community for hundreds of years. I think it actually came out like the 1700s. But what that word means is attributing human emotions or characteristics to non-human things, like looking at a waterfall and saying, oh, it's fierce or it's strong or something like that. But when you look at an animal and you say an animal is fearful or happy, a scientist who is an anthropomorphist will say that you're giving the animal human emotions, that it's you're anthropomorphizing that animal because animals don't have emotions. And that attitude has also led to a lot of exploitation of animals, because there's a large part of society that doesn't believe that animals have feelings, that doesn't believe they suffer, that look at them as more as mechanical. People that fish who think fish don't feel pain, which is nonsense. There are people that exploit animals for their pleasure because they either believe the animal doesn't suffer or because they believe the suffering of the animal is of no consequence, is something that should not be considered. So I believe as we go forward as a species, as we go forward as a civilization, more and more we are going to becoming more and more aware of animals and more their caretakers. A lot of people quote things from the Bible about, that we have dominion over the animals. Well, dominion doesn't mean you can exploit them. Dominion means you're supposed to be the caretakers of the planet. A lot of people, there's a lot of religious people who go over that all the time, who advocate, care and proper consideration to animals. But exploiting animals, if you have a dominion over someone, it doesn't mean that you have the right to exploit them. And that's where sometimes we go a little awry. Now, I used to fish. I used to go to circuses. I still do go to zoos from time, and I try to look for what it is that we're talking about here. I try to go to zoos that are sanctuaries, zoos where animals have been brought to them because they're injured, and not for entertainment purposes, but for refuge purposes, like Dreher Park Zoo and Bush Wildlife. Now, these are zoos, but they're sanctuaries. The animals there cannot be in the wild anymore because they've been injured, they were shot, they were found injured somehow. These are the type of zoos that I do go to. And even though I see some of these behaviors that we're talking about, as far as pacing in the cages or stuff like that, because they're out of their environment, the bottom line is I know that animal can't be in their natural habitat anymore. They have the story of the animal and what happened to them and why they can't be released back into the wild. So they try to create as good an environment for them as they can, as large an environment and as natural to what they were used to as they can. But just actual zoos where animals are kept in small cages, I'm very much against. Circus acts, I'm very much against, and I'm going to read to you why. Now, before I get into some of the specifics about circuses and zoos, did you want to ask me anything?
Well, my mind is going towards something that you said a couple minutes ago, such as the difference between a sanctuary and a regular zoo. and I have some questions about that. It's a word, first of all, and it's only as good as the people that understand it. So how are we going to know, Shell, if indeed a sanctuary is a safe haven and these animals, because they can't talk, they can't write anybody a letter, they can't see their congressman, they can't do anything like that. How are we going to know that when somebody tacks the word sanctuary on their business, and they charge $15 a head to come in and look at these animals that are supposedly, quote-unquote, in their natural habitat, how do we know when we're really not being scammed and when that's really the truth? Is there an organization, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, but maybe this is something we need to find out, is there somebody that sits in a higher seat that actually evaluates, you know, like we know that there's
always
somebody.
Well, you know, if you look off website or you can actually contact them, it's ARFF. It stands for Animal Rights Foundation of Florida, ARFF.org. They have a lot of resources there. I am fairly certain that they would be able to answer that of how to know. The research, like I said, this pamphlet I'm looking at right now is back to 2005. And I know that they're heavily, I didn't get anything newer from them because I haven't been to Sublime, but Sublime always has all their newsletters out front. You can take them, they're free, they don't charge for them. But I know that they're heavily, heavily into investigating this. I'm fairly certain that they're going to know. Now, PETA would be another good source. Any animal rights, PETA is probably one of the biggest organizations. And because they go around the country and they look at different zoos, because they even talk about good zoos, okay, and that even good zoos are still not an appropriate habitat, that although it's nice to see an animal that came from Africa, you know, like you're seeing these lions and elephants, there are, like Lion Country Safari, where they try to give them a natural environment, and you see these lions roaming around in these huge plains. Even the good zoos, there are still some issues with, because when the animals get old, now I don't know if Lion Country Safari does this, but some of the other good zoos were doing practices like when it was time for when the animals were getting older, they would sell them to free shoot areas. So you see this lion get released, and a guy shoot him with a rifle because he's like in a free range area, and he's captive, and he can't even get away from the guy trying to shoot him. And this guy thinks he's such a big successful hunter because he shot a confined lion. It's ridiculous. So that was one of the big outrages that ARF and PETA were trying to fight against, that these zoo animals, everybody's going to see them and, oh, nice, 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 but then when they get later on in years, they're getting sold off to animal research labs, or they're getting sold to these free-range shooting places so that somebody can say, oh, I shot a wild lion, or I shot a this, or I shot a that, you know, and have these trophies for their walls, which is, again, it goes to our society's idea of it being okay to exploit animals. And again, this is cultural. You talk about the rodeo in this country, which is extremely cultural. You have people that are raised in the rodeo, and it's their life. You talk about the bull run in Spain. You know, this is cultural. It invokes a lot of emotion. You know, you have people that get very injured doing rodeos. You get people that get very injured doing the bull runs, being bullfighters. It's very cultural, yet at its core, it's cruel and exploitive to the animals. Regardless of how dangerous it is to the humans, all right, it is extremely cruel and exploitive to the animals. And the only reason they become so violent is because they are. I mean, look at what's done to the bull before it goes after the bullfighter. You know, he has spears thrown in his back, for God's sake. Look at what happens to the bulls when you're talking about a rodeo rider. All right? They're injured and tormented to make them run out of the chute like that. They're hit with electrical prods. So this animal is infuriated and mistreated. So people don't look at the treatment of the animals. They look at the sport because it's cultural. So it's really, it's going to take time because people have to enhance their sensitivities, and they have to start realizing that if something can suffer, it doesn't matter if it's a child, if it's an elderly person, if it's a cat or a dog, if something can suffer, it should be given rights to not suffer. We as human beings don't have the rights to inflict suffering on another species just because it's different than us. You know, now that's not to say that if you're being attacked by a wild dog or a bear that you can't shoot it. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about exploiting an animal for our pleasure through entertainment, like confining an animal for a circus or in a zoo or tormenting it in a rodeo or something like that. And again, a lot of this is cultural, and it's going to have to take a good percentage of society to start recognizing that. But I think as human beings, that's where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it all boils down to, you know, personal behavior and doing what you know is right. And so much of our lives are about our own personal behavior. I guess the biggest other question I have, and I, as much as I respect all your knowledge, you probably can't answer it either. If they did stop things like the Big Top has been around since the 1800s. It's like a, when you talk about cultural, I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, Cirque du Soleil, they replaced animals with people.
Right.
Right? Most of their performances are just with people, and the people actually take the place of the animals. And so many of our art forms are just that. I remember in high school, one of my mother's favorite stories was me telling her about my gym class where I had all these girls who went into interpretive dance and drama, and they'd walk around in our locker room pretending they were cats and stuff like that. And my mother would be hysterical when I'd show her all the things that they were doing, you know, like sitting in the corner and licking their paws and all this kind of stuff. And they were all doing this because the teacher told them that it would put them in a place of understanding a little bit more. When you interpretate something, you have to be able to get inside the head or the being that you're interpreting. So when I watch Cirque du Soleil, which I, you know, totally enamored by, I cannot believe people can do that.
Yeah, me too.
But, you know, but then you watch a Bengal tiger, which I am in awe of, walk across a field, and there's nothing else in the whole world like it, is there? I mean, nothing. Their grace, they weigh, what, 300-500 pounds, some of them, and yet they jump like a kitten. And, I mean, they just blow me away. So this hurts me, even though you and I have had this discussion many times. I feel like before I can really, you know, absorb myself in the welfare of the animals, I feel like the first step should be people. And doesn't mean that my heart isn't there. It just means that it's overwhelming to get people to be nice to each other, and to get the same people to be nice to animals almost seems really far out of reach at this point in time. So if we were to organize circuses, what would we do, Shell? What would we do? Have circus cops, zoo cops? I don't understand how this could be fixed unless they're abolished. What do you think?
The only way that circuses could be fixed would be to not have them travel, number one, because the traveling is part of the is part of the abuse. The animals are traumatized. A lot of times they're transported in very small, I mean, you know, they can't be in free-roaming areas. They have to be in small cages. So they, you know, they plop somewhere for 2 weeks, and then they're back in their cages for, you know, for a day or two trip somewhere else. So the traveling, the constant traveling is part of the abuse for the animals, because it's very unnatural for them to be constantly thrown in cages. You know, they're in and around their own excrement. They can't get away from it. They're not eating naturally. So that's part of the trauma. So if somebody wanted to create a humane circus, then it would have to be something that was stationary, that people would travel to, not that the circus would travel to you, but that you would travel to the circus. And it would have to be based around a natural environment where when they weren't performing, they were in free, open grazing areas, like some of these, what they called the good zoos, like Lion Country Safari, where they're in as natural environment to what they're used to as possible, where they were around like animals. The problem with circuses is that you usually have one elephant. You usually don't have many elephants. These animals, all animals are communal. They want to be around other like animals. They don't want to be all by themselves in a cage, whether it be a bear or a lion or an elephant. They're communal animals. So here in the circus environment, and this is heart-wrenching to me when I actually realize it, can you imagine living your entire life chained to a wall, never seeing another human being, surrounded by all other species staring in at you and poking at you and oohing and aahing at you, and yet you never see another human for the rest of your life? You're just something for people to gawk at or other species to gawk at. It's a horrific life. It's miserable. They lose their sense of identity. They don't have any camaraderie. And for the ones that where they do have multiple of a certain species, they're not kept together. They're still kept apart. So they still don't have the ability to commiserate with even their own species when you do have more than one. That's why that one elephant went nuts. This video was out years ago. But this one elephant who was with two others, and they thought all three of them were going to stampede, couldn't take it anymore. The trainer started whipping it in the show to make it stand up, and it lost it. It trampled the trainer, and it knocked down one of the stadiums. A lot of people got hurt. This was in another country. It didn't happen in the United States. But it was a terrible the elephant finally lost it, and it couldn't take it anymore. One of the things they talk about in everything I've read, from multiple sources, by the way, is that the way they get these animals to do these tricks that are unnatural, you know, making a lion, you know, sit back on its haunches, making an elephant sit back on its haunches and then not put its feet down, come almost near a guy but not actually step on him, make a bear ride a bicycle and stuff like this, is they torture these animals. If they don't do what they're being told to do, they get whipped. They get poked with these bar hooks. They get electrical shocks. They use a hot pan, a hot disc, for when the elephants go to put their feet down, that they burn the bottom of their feet so that they can't put their foot down. I mean, and then you're watching this act and you're saying, oh my God, look how smart that elephant. No, the elephant's not smart. The elephant is tortured, and the elephant's trying to not be injured again. So it's doing what the trainer is telling it to do because it knows if it doesn't, it's going to get burned or it's going to get whipped or it's going to get poked in the face or something like that. So when you start realizing that what you're seeing in circus acts is the result of torture and mistreatment, in me it invokes anger and disgust, and that's why I can no longer go to circuses. Did I enjoy the acts when I was younger? Yes. But now it only invokes anger in me and a sense of wanting to protect the animals and not engage in going to circuses anymore, because it's not a happy life for these animals. And exploiting an animal just for my entertainment, to me, is unacceptable. I can't go there.
So, but you don't see a fix, I take it. I agree with everything you just said, and I think anybody who's got any kind of head on their shoulders doesn't want, unless they're a sick individual, which there are a few of, doesn't want to think that for you to laugh at an elephant doing a trick or a bear riding a bicycle or anything like that, something cruel was done to them. I don't think most of the people I know wouldn't like that thought, for sure. So, but do you see anywhere in the evolution of our universe the opportunity for something to change with that so that we could enjoy
the only way that you could enjoy circus acts is, like I said, to improve, to make it a stationary, attraction, not something that travels. Because, like I said, the traveling is part of the trauma that these animals go through. The other thing is to have it attached to a natural environment as best as we can make for them. And the third thing would be to have animal trainers that use positive reinforcement instead of torture to train the animals. Now, I don't know how that would be accomplished with wild animals. I know it can be done with dogs and cats and other types of animals. There's this one trainer that was on, what's that show, America's Got Talent? And this guy came out there, and he had, like, cats and dogs and birds and all kinds of animals that generally you wouldn't have in one act together. He used very, very humane training techniques. He used positive reinforcement, and he got these animals to do all kinds of stuff. You know, you had the dog with the cat on its back and the bird sitting on the cat's head. It was incredible that he got all these animals to do this. But he did it through, I mean, they showed him outside the act. They went to his house. These animals have a beautiful environment that they live in. They're all very well loved. You know, he's sitting at his home watching TV, and all the dogs are on the couch next to him. And so, I mean, his animals aren't caged and stuff. But he trains them through using positive reinforcement behavioral techniques to get him to do what they want them to do. And there's other trainers that do animal acts such as this with smaller animals, not wild animals, that are very successful. I would tend to think that there should be ways of using behavior modification, positive reinforcement. Torture without beating them, you know, without exposing them to heat and fear. That's what breaks my heart. If there's a way of getting these animals to perform where they're enjoying it, where they're feeling an interaction with their trainer, all right, then that's different. And then when they're not performing, to release them into a more natural environment for them where they can stretch their legs and run, not where as soon as they're done acting, they're chained against the wall again.
Honey, I didn't hear any of that, and I don't think anybody else did either, because I lost you, and then my phone lost connection. It still says it's connected, but it wasn't.
Oh, okay. So do you know what the last thing was that you heard?
Yeah, the last thing was, like, 2 minutes ago, you said, I ask you what we could do that would make a difference, and I heard you, like, in shorthand, and then I couldn't hear anything.
Okay, well, basically what I said, I'll just repeat it, is that the only way that I think that circuses could be something that remain in our society would be, number one, to have them not be traveling, that it would have to be an attraction that people would travel to, just like Disney or anything else, because part of the abuse and the trauma comes from the constant packing up in these little travel cages where they're, you know, they can't get away from from their own excrement, and they're not being fed naturally, and they can't stretch their legs, and, you know, I mean,
I
wouldn't want to be constantly, you know, walked around the like that, okay? So that's one thing. The second thing is to have the circus attached to a natural free-roaming environment so that when the animals are not performing, they're released into a natural habitat, as natural as we can make it for them, okay, where they're not caged or chained against a wall, but they're allowed to free roam. They're allowed to be around others of their breed, like multiple elephants, multiple lions and tigers together, so that they have some camaraderie of their own species. And the third thing would be to get behavioral trainers that understand positive reinforcement. I've seen animal acts. I remember watching America's Got Talent once, and this guy came out, and he had cats, dogs, and birds, and I think even pigs. And so he had four different species in his act. They all interacted with each other, and then they showed this guy at his home, and all the animals run free. He was like the animal whisperer. But everything was done with positive reinforcement. He taught these animals to do these really complicated routines, but all through positive reinforcement. It was the most amazing. And I've seen two different trainers like that now with multiple animals in these very complicated acts, and they were incredible. It was fascinating to watch, very enjoyable, very funny routines, but you could see that the animals were very, very happy and well taken care of. I don't see why that could not be done with circus animals, where they could be trained using positive reinforcement, where they actually enjoyed their performing and weren't traumatized by it. You have to understand that when the lion sits back or the elephant sits back and the trainer is using that whip as a guide, the animal's doing it because they're afraid they're going to get injured again. They're afraid they're going to be made to feel pain. So they're not performing because they're smart. They're performing out of self-preservation, which to me is heart-wrenching. But
yeah,
when you have animals perform from positive reinforcement, they're performing because they're having fun. They want to make the trainer happy. Because they're getting a treat at the end. So I believe there should be a way of training circus animals using positive reinforcement and not using torture.
Well, if I can remember years ago just going to the little circus that was at the swap shop here in Fort Lauderdale. And it was a family who had been doing circuses forever. They weren't big like Barnum and Bailey or Ringling Brothers or the conjoining circus that eventually appeared on the circus front, but a small family. I mean, they all did parts of the show. They all were clowns. They all did acts. They all did the horseback riding. They trained elephants, and they did a lion act way back when in the 80s. And I thought they were good. I mean, it was a free circus at the swap shop, you know, and we'd take all the grandchildren and we had fun watching them. And you sit very close, you know, because it was inside the swap shop. And I watched, and whatever the elephants did, they got a treat. They'd reach down with their trunk and they'd, you know, hand something to them in their trunk, or I didn't see anything like that for the lion act or anything. But when you went outside and walked down the back part of the swap shop, you saw these small cages, like what you used to see in cartoons, the little tiny cage, like train cars, but little, you know, almost like toys.
Yeah.
And one lion would fill up one car, and that's how they would transport them from where they kept them, which wasn't right there on the site of the swap shop. I never knew where it was, but that's how they transport them every Sunday for this show. And they ended up being closed. I never understood exactly what happened. I heard all kinds of rumors. I can't repeat any of them because there was never much basis to truth, so I'm not going to say all the different things I heard. But
Actually, interestingly enough, this particular pamphlet I have from ARF, where they were the driving force behind closing that swap shop circus. It's actually in this article that I'm seeing. They had, because of all the abuses that they found happening behind the scenes, swap shop closes curtains on circus, Hannaford Family Circus finally
evicts.
Yeah, and they go in here with the, you know, with all the different abuses that were happening to the animals, and they said it seemed like, you know, people would come there because they thought it was such a sweet show, but they didn't know what was happening to the animals behind the scene.
Yeah.
The animals died in transit. That the vehicles were very hot. A lot of times they weren't given water, and they lost a lot of their animals due to death. It's just very, very inhumane. Transporting, I mean, they go into a whole litany here of why they put such a campaign to shut them down.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are some of the stories I heard, and then I heard personal stories about some of the Hannaford family, and like I said, I never knew what was true or what wasn't true. But at face value, which is the point I'm going to make here, it seemed lovely. It did seem lovely. And I think that is one of the issues when somebody gives you cold, hard truth about something and you've looked at it and seen it with your own eyes and didn't see any of that, then it's hard to swallow. It's a real bitter pill to swallow, to know that something that has brought you some joy in your lifetime, it's hard to look at it from another point of view, which is going to be the hardest part. And I also worry when I see, you know, I mean, because I remember seeing the first time I went to Metro Zoo in Miami, Shell. They had this big castle for the Bengal tigers,
mm-hmm.
and water all around it. And the tiger could go in and out of the in the sun or in the shade. And let's face it, Florida, if there's no trees on an island, it gets god-awful hot. So there was a plaque there about Siberian tigers and Bengal tigers and stuff like that, about how, you know, they enjoy the hot weather and they enjoy this and they enjoy that. And I thought to myself, they maybe enjoy it to some degree because they're climatized for it, but it still seemed... And then if you went to the Metro Zoo in the heat of August or September, you saw no animals. You saw no animals because they stayed in where it was cool.
Actually, that's not what happened. Part of the article from ARF is that, and it's the same article about the Hannaford Circus, is that Florida zoos are contributing to a nationwide crisis involving the breeding and sale of exotic animals, and ARF is asking them to take the lead in finding a solution. We're starting with Miami Metro Zoo, former home to Edith, the chimpanzee pictured above, who is still languishing in a sad, filthy underground cement pit at a roadside menagerie in Texas. Like Edith, other animals who are born or sold into the zoo industry are shuffled around with little or no concern for their comfort or safety. They become pawns of a profit-driven industry which claims to care about animals but is doing little to back up their assertion. ARF is asking Metro Zoo to implement policies that would ensure that no animal again suffers Edith's fate or any similarly horrific lives that others cast off zoo residents have faced. So evidently she was a resident of Metro Zoo. They sold her to the menagerie in Texas, and then they didn't even put her on display. She was being kept in an underground cement pit, and she was starting to rock, and she was showing signs that she had, you know, kind of lost her mind, just sat there and rocked all day. And it, when ARF found out about it, they started trying to do something to get Edith set free. We think it is the least they can do, but so far Metro Zoo has refused to take any responsibility for this and any other tragedy suffered by its former zoo residents. So unfortunately, a lot of times when you don't see the animals there anymore, it's because they've been sold into either these free-roaming shooting ranges, or they've been sold to animal research labs and stuff like that, and that's what's so disturbing. People don't understand what happens to the animals when they're not on display anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not talking about not being there at all. You could see them inside. At Metro Zoo, they even have some rock formations around the gorillas. And I was very impressed by that, because you can walk into the cavern and here's this enormous gorilla laying against a window. And you can see him. I mean, you know, you can see him up close. And, I mean, I just stood there and stared at his fingers and his mouth and thought to myself, oh, my gosh, this is, like, amazing.
You
because from far away.
Environment for a gorilla? Don't they climb trees and swing in trees? I mean, there's nothing natural about that environment to them.
Well, at Metro Zoo, their domain had trees and had water and had these little caverns where they could go in to get out of the sunshine. That was the same with the castle for the tigers. You could see the tigers in there laying down, and their tails would be, you know, moving around every now and then so you could see them, but they wouldn't be outside in the heat of the day. That was the point I was making. When they talk about tigers being okay with the heat, it didn't look like they were okay with the heat to me.
Well, let me read this real quick because we're almost out of time. But this is this was written by Dick Gregory and Richard Pryor, who are big advocates against circuses. And interestingly enough, what they called the campaign is "The Slave Trade is Alive and Kicking," and so they're trying to get it to stop. Richard Pryor says, "But for the use of physical punishment by their oppressors, animals would never be part of a circus willingly." Dick Gregory said, "Don't support the enslavement of any living being. Boycott circuses that hold animal slaves." Kenny, and then it goes on with telling why they're saying this. Kenny, a baby elephant, died after the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus forced him to perform while sick. In the wild, elephants stay with their mothers until they are 15 years old, but Ringling took Kenny away from his mother at only age 2 and sent him off on the road. A Ringling video captured a Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey trainer whipping an elephant in the face and gouging her with a bull hook, and this is one of the techniques they used. When animals in circuses are not on display, their miserable lives consist of cages, chains, and often beatings. They have no mental stimulation, privacy, or exercise. Those who naturally roam in family groups are chained or caged alone. And this is one of the biggest atrocities, that they're not even allowed to commingle with their own species. In the ring, the whips, muzzles, and electric prods remind us that these animals are forced to go against their nature and do senseless tricks. After years of traveling, circuses dump old animals at roadside zoos or exotic animal auctions, which sell them to hunting ranges to be shot as trophies. Many countries and states have banned or severely restricted use of animals in entertainment. And this is going back many years ago. Sears and Roebuck have recently pulled its sponsorship of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. So the circus is trying to make a resurgence. And because they feel enough time has gone by that people don't remember anymore. But when you go to the zoocosis checklist, which is the checklist that these people use to see if an animal is suffering, you have bar biting, you have licking, repeated licking of the bars and walls, and I've seen that sometimes in zoos.
Mm-hmm.
Pacing.
Me too.
Continuous pacing back and forth or from side to side. Neck twisting. Now, this is something that's very disturbing. When an animal cranes its head back and twists its head around in an unnatural way, that's actually a sign of trauma, of emotional trauma. Vomiting, circling, walking around and around, placing footsteps in the same position. Coprophagia, which is playing with or eating their own excrement. All right, this is not something an animal would do in the wild, but it's
not even monkeys? Not even monkeys?
No, they don't do that in
the
wild.
They're the only ones I've ever seen do that, I mean, constant.
Yeah. Well,
so that's not normal.
They
okay.
do out of frustration. Head bobbing, where the head bobs up and down again and again and again, very repeatedly. Swaying, rolling or swaying motion from side to side is not playful. It is a sign of extreme stress. Over-grooming, grooming to excess, including hair plucking, and animals may have even show bald patches. And I've seen that on some of these captive animals.
Me too.
See bald patches.
Me too.
You know, it's like they pick at themselves. And then self-mutilation, repeated tail biting or leg chewing. And I've also seen that. I went recently at one of these sanctuaries, so I know it was an animal that can't be released out. and the animal was like butting its head against the wall. It just stood there and it just kept just hitting its forehead on the wall. It actually got me upset, you know.
Yeah. Well, it is upsetting. I gotta stop us though, because we won't have a chance to say goodbye to everybody because we're down to 5 seconds. So this is a great story. We'll have to let it rest a little bit and then talk about it again and see if anything's happening.
Okay.
Thanks for all the input, Shell. Of course, now I have a stomach ache, but that's not your fault. more stuff to worry about in our world. Jeez, it's kind of sad, isn't it? Anyway, everybody go out and have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow. And tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit more about this school in Sayreville. This has blossomed into a very awful story, so we're going to talk about that. So everybody have a great day. God bless. Thanks, Shell. I will talk to you after a while.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Glad you called in. And just remember that all you have to do is start with your own better choices, and you can change the world. Have a great day.
Amen. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.